Hello and welcome to the third episode of the brand new It's Nice That podcast. This is the show where we talk to leading designers, illustrators, creative directors and photographers about the delights and dramas of being a creative. We want to scrub away the Instagram gloss and hear the honest truth from people who have built careers out of their creativity. How do they come up with their best ideas? What's the secret to staying inspired? And what happens when creative projects go awry? My name's Matt Alagaya. I'm the editor-in-chief of It's Nice That, and today I'll be talking to the creative director and graphic designer Eric Hu. We'll hear how he spent the past year creating NFTs and what that shift has meant for his practice and his feelings about the industry more broadly. Then later on, we'll be heading to Sydney for this episode's Nice Note. We'll hear from one of our favorite animation directors in that city. That's all coming up on the It's Nice That podcast. First, though, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined again on the podcast by my colleague, Lucy Boughton, our senior editor. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, not too bad. What have you been working on today?
Today, I've mostly been working on our upcoming Extra Nice campaign, which is called The Balancing Act, which I'm really looking forward to. It's kind of a look at how the past 2 years have affected our kind of creative working habits, from looking at maybe adopting a four-day week to maybe moving out of the city. And yeah, we've had some really interesting responses to a survey we actually sent out with our audience.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait to see that. So today we're hearing from Eric Hu. You've listened to the interview already. Is there anything in particular, I guess, that you'd like our listeners to keep an ear out for?
Yeah, I think I would just say go into it with an open mind. I think that the subject of NFTs is something that it's very difficult to wrap your head around, as well, it is for me anyway. And I definitely wasn't totally sure how I felt about it, but I feel like Eric describes everything so concisely and in a really visual way for you to understand. I think there was one part where he described the blockchain as like an Excel sheet that everybody can see. And I was like, yeah, I can actually wrap my head around this rather than the word blockchain.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely wanted to say that as well. I think, you know, I'm sure plenty of people will hear those dreaded letters NFT and kind of roll their eyes. I can almost hear the groans now from our listeners. But I do really urge everyone to listen to this interview, because it really changed my mind about NFTs and how we might want to think about them. There were so many different things that I didn't know they were kind of capable of doing in terms of, you know, changing the way that we think about ownership in artwork and who benefits from that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it really made me think a lot about how I'm definitely guilty of not liking a lot of the work that NFTs have produced aesthetically. We will mention the chimps. Is it chimps or apes? I can't remember.
We can mention the apes, yeah.
But I think there was a really brilliant point that Eric pointed out about how it's kind of looking at it in the same way as saying that if you opened Instagram for the first time ever and there was a piece of artwork that you didn't like, that then you would just not use Instagram at all.
He's really just really open and honest about things, which is so refreshing. I mean, he talks in our chat about some of the trauma he has around money because of his upbringing and how he feels that that's kind of influenced his feelings around the NFT space, which is, yeah, just it's really refreshing to hear someone be so kind of open and honest about that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think he speaks really well about how we can look at the design industry differently in terms of co-ops, and maybe NFTs are the answer to that and maybe they're not, but that's definitely a very vital conversation to be having. Go into it with an open mind and not just associate it with some of the questionable artwork you may have seen in that space.
So yeah, forget about the apes for a minute. all right, thanks very much, Lucy. Thanks for your thoughts on that. Now, without further ado, let's hear that chat with Eric Hu. Hi, Eric. Thanks so much for joining us today. Welcome to the It's Nice That podcast.
It's my pleasure, Matt. I'm really excited when I got your email about coming on. You know, happy to always be involved with anything that It's Nice That offers. You know, I'm just really grateful for all the support all through the years.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Well, thank you for joining us. And yeah, it's great to have you on. And I guess as well, how's your week going? Just generally, how's your cat Gyoza?
Gyoza has a little brother now, actually, Pierogi. So we're going with the dumpling themed names. Yeah, Pierogi is 6 months old and Gyoza is 6 years old. We were really afraid of how well they were going to get along, but they really love each other. So I think when I just had Gyoza, I would just leave the door to the office open and have him come hang out. But I think lately, especially with like meetings and whatnot, I've had to just close the door because Pierogi just kind of comes in like the Tasmanian devil and just starts like knocking down books. and everything. But no, otherwise, it's a happy family.
Great. I'm very pleased to hear it. And I love the dumpling theme. So I guess for our conversation today, we're going to be focusing on something you've started experimenting with relatively recently in your career. And it's something that's had a big impact on your creative practice and also on your thoughts about the creative industry more broadly. I'm talking here, obviously, about your forays into the NFT space. We're going to get onto what NFTs actually are and why we should care about them. But I wanted to start by asking you, what was the first time you heard about blockchain technology? That's the tech that underpins NFTs being used in a creative context. Who was it who really kind of, I guess, put it into your consciousness to start with?
Blockchain has been on my radar for quite some time now. I wouldn't say I was really early in on it, but I think as early as 2011, I had, you know, started paying attention to certain conversations surrounding Bitcoin and then later on Ethereum. But I wasn't really an active participant. But I think basically around 2015, or maybe it was a year before that, it might have been 2014, I got an email from this guy, Jesse Walden. Jesse Walden was a manager in the music industry. We had talked about working previously when he was managing Solange Knowles and Blood Orange. And so I had known him as just like this figure in the music industry, but he was actually starting this new company that eventually became MediaChain. At the time, it was called Mine. I really didn't know much going into the meeting, but I think when I walked away from it, I almost got the spooks in a good way. Basically, Jesse Walden was building this company that was like an answer to a question that I've had for years. Essentially, he was building a Shazam for images. Whereas like if you saw an image online and you were intrigued by it, you didn't know who created that image, you would be able to just look up an entire family tree. And that sounds simple, but it's actually really hard to do. It's a lot harder than audio in a lot of ways because of the ability for images to really become memes and transform themselves and really reshape. I think just like a simple example is like, you know, when you have like a t-shirt of the Mona Lisa on it versus like the Mona Lisa actually in the museums in Paris versus a mug at a souvenir shop of also the Mona Lisa. To a computer, those are three separate images. But I think to you and I, we know that as one idea of the Mona Lisa and two being like remixes of it. The way our mind is able to kind of make that connection in our head is actually enormously difficult for a computer to do. And also it was something that you can't really rely on a single company to really tell you like who did what, because I think for many reasons that would be like, I think fairly dystopian and also just like impractical. And I think it would be too much kind of authority on one single company. And so they were going to try to do this using the blockchain that was available through Bitcoin. But for a lot of reasons, Bitcoin wasn't really designed to do that. I think a lot of people don't really know what a blockchain is. And it's like really hard to kind of explain it. But a blockchain, you could think of it as like a spreadsheet that's like visible throughout the entire world. Everybody could see each different cell. In many ways, this was, I think if other pieces kind of fit in that puzzle, it would have been really perfect for that technology, but it wasn't. And it wasn't until Ethereum came along where Ethereum allowed itself to be programmable, where you could write applications that didn't have anything to do with money, but could still take advantage of that kind of global kind of record and that global public like ledger, it became really feasible. But he was really trying to build this canonical image. And he was trying to deal with this like trend towards like authorship being kind of dissolved, you know, through Pinterest and through different kind of feeds and whatnot. And that was something that was like top of mind as well. It was actually part of my thesis at Yale. You know, what does graphic design look like in a time like post Instagram, post Facebook, and post like Tumblr? I think I graduated in 2012, so I really didn't anticipate how much I would be right about that and how kind of scary it's gotten. I walked away from that meeting kind of shook, like, wow, this could be a really big thing. To me, it also would have taken, I think, years for them to achieve their goal. And so they were searching for this thing called the canonical image, which was like an image where you could really see like the entire history of it. I think NFTs offer like the closest pathway to doing that. And so when NFTs kind of came into that discussion, I immediately thought about MediaChain and what they had been trying to do like years earlier. And it really felt kind of like things kind of going full circle. It was also full circle in a lot of ways for my practice because of what I studied in grad school and because of the early kind of work I did on the web.
Let's look at that now, because I guess I want to fast forward to maybe last year when NFTs were kind of having their moment, as it were. And I guess MediaChain had planted a bit of a seed in your mind. Just talk us through what happened last year, yeah, with you and with NFTs.
So I think towards late 2020, I had started seeing the word NFT in conversation. And I did a little bit of effort trying to look things up at first. And I was like, non-fungible token. I only understood what two of those words meant. It really kind of eluded me at the time and I didn't really think much of it. But I think the more I got into reading about it, I started to really kind of understand the offerings, but I still had a lot of hesitations. I think a lot of people had some of the same hesitations as I did at the time, who are also now, I think, very deep into making and engaging with NFTs. But it really wasn't until, I think, early February 2021, where I think a lot of people on Twitter were talking about this new protocol called Zora. It's not a platform like Instagram or Tumblr. It's like a protocol closer to like email, whereas like there isn't a single kind of email service. And Zora was really trying to think about royalties, where like how can people get compensated even when an NFT gets like resold and whatnot? Like how could they program, I think, royalties for life? And so a lot of people were really talking about that. And they had this kind of meme where you tweeted like three emojis if you're really interested in this. It was like this kind of secret thing. I didn't really have the patience for things like that normally, but I decided to bite. And so I tweeted these emojis and I got a message from one of the co-founders of Zora. And basically, to keep a long story short, they had been following my work for years and they thought that my work would be really great in the space. I think the subtext was that a lot of the art was like really bad in the space. And so they needed people who were at least curious about this technology to try to engage with it. It's really crazy. I think when I look back at really small exchanges and how big of an impact they would make. And it's really hard to really predict that when these conversations would happen in real time. But I think Dee and I had basically had a lovely Google Meet where he answered every single question I had towards like, how do I mint an NFT? How do I have an Ethereum wallet? Like there's a lot of steps really involved diving into the NFT space, especially for someone like me, where I knew technically what the benefits of crypto was, but I was like really afraid of cryptocurrency for a lot of reasons. I grew up with a lot of trauma around money, and it was something that I wasn't really privy to. Like my father also worked at a casino when I was really younger. So I think I was really exposed early on to what happens when you let, I think, a gambling instinct come in. And there was this association with that, with cryptocurrency. And so it was something that I was like really afraid of. But I think Dee showed me kind of the other side. And all he simply did was to show me how to mint an NFT. And I think a lot of people who are skeptical of NFTs but haven't made one, I don't think they'll understand really. It's one of those things where you kind of have to do it to really understand like how it feels. It felt different from uploading an image. And I think because of the things that I've been thinking about for about 10 years at that point, about, you know, how do images exist in a network and how do designers deal with images on a network and how do ordinary people consume images? I saw a bit of Lego pieces to a lot of potential and unanswered questions that I had. And from that, I think I was like pretty hooked. Serendipitously, like Dee also happened to purchase that NFT that I minted. He just told me like, hey, do you have any like unused work on your computer that you just want to put out there? And I said, yeah. And so I found this random image and we minted it into an NFT. And then he was like, try to do it again. And I tried to upload the exact same image and it couldn't, because that same image had already been uploaded before on the Ethereum network, not on Zora, but in the system. And without getting too technical, it knew that it was the same image. I was just like, wow, this is really big. Like what this could do with authorship and crediting people and whatnot. And it wasn't a meeting that I've been looking forward to. It wasn't something that I was like super excited about. I think I was merely curious about it. But I remember at the time I think my mind was kind of preoccupied with a lot of my kind of client work at the time. And it was during a really kind of stressful period. And I've been tempted to cancel a lot of times too. But, you know, I'm really glad I didn't.
I mean, you've brought up so much there, which is so, so interesting about NFTs and I guess your personal experience as well, including, which we'll get onto, the kind of the quality of the work, which is something you touched on a bit earlier. I guess just get us into the mindset that you had in early 2021 in terms of your creative practice, because I guess we've chatted about this before and it seems like you were slightly disillusioned with certain parts of whether it's your practice or more the creative industry in general at that point.
In order to, I think, figure out the state of mind I was in 2021, I think it's important for me to almost think back to 2011, I think almost like 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I completed my first year in grad school and I started developing a few specific anxieties. And these anxieties ended up being my obsessions for the next decade. The first anxiety was that the internet was like collapsing from this constellation of millions of separate websites and communities into a handful, I would say 5 to 10 concentrated platforms. And I intuitively knew that this was going to change how design was going to function. I think the second anxiety that I had was that the internet was collapsing from millions of separate websites and communities into 5 smaller platforms. And this was going to change how people behaved in general. And I think both things kind of touched on I think, a lot of specific fears about building a sustainable practice. I think by the time I graduated from grad school, it became very clear to me that I think just putting my work out onto the internet and just having a portfolio wasn't going to be enough, and that I was entering an industry that was well on its way to becoming part of an attention economy, where you had to not only have a body of work to have a sustainable, independent creative practice, you had to have like a personality. And by the time I got to 2021, it basically had been 10 years of this shit. And I was just like really honestly tired. And despite having benefited from, you know, these two phenomena, like for many years, it was just something for me that just felt unsustainable for me. And I think I've been very fortunate to have an audience and to have created like a name for myself. And so I knew that if it felt daunting for me, it must have felt 10 times more daunting for a designer who didn't have access to these kind of privileges and this kind of access. And so the pandemic also kind of put this on hyperspeed, where at the beginning of the pandemic, as client work started drying up, I became really kind of fearful. I think a lot of this podcast is going to be me talking about me being afraid. I think I'm just an anxious person in general, but I really thought that like there was a chance that I was going to lose all my savings, because I think a few months in, as the client work started drying up, I was really trying to save every single dollar, because I had just quit a full-time job to become a freelancer just months before the pandemic hit. I knew I saved up like 6 months of it, but I didn't know if this was going to be a multi-year thing and how long this was going to happen. I really started to think about myself, like I put myself in a financial situation where I'm really dependent on clients. But if the clients aren't here, like what else can I do to sustain my practice? The current answers were really dissatisfying. It was like, I could start a YouTube channel where I could give advice. I could start up Substack where I could give advice. I could post a bunch of Instagram reels about my process. I think all the answers were about marketing myself in a way that would make myself useful to other people. Not that I have an issue with that. I'm very interested in those things, but it's not what I set out to do. It's not what I imagined my life would be as a designer when I was younger. It's not the reason I entered that kind of profession. And so I think there was that. But I think all in all, like I knew that that would be contributing to, I think, a more toxic internet, for better or worse. I think I was born in a very lucky time. You know, I'm 33 years old, 1989, so I'm not young and I'm not old. When I was young, most of my friends weren't on the internet and I was. And so I occupied this interesting thing where I saw a lot of the early web before a lot of people my age did. And so in some ways, compared to people my age, I was able to kind of identify larger kind of trends in the internet simply just because I was there to witness, I think, the first time these patterns started emerging. I basically saw the web transition from web one to web two. I would say the transition began when I was in high school, and it really kind of peaked by the time I hit grad school. I think a lot of people that are younger than me, especially, you know, like Gen Z kind of folks, like web two is all they know. And they've grown up where Google and Facebook, you know, those companies were synonymous with the internet. But I remember a time when that wasn't the case. It was really interesting because like by the time I was in graduate school, I had seen kind of just Facebook and Instagram kind of rise and the proliferation of image blogs. And that was starting to create this almost kind of substrate of the internet. Around that time, I also kind of noticed this kind of eerie thing too, where in the early days of the internet, when people talked about seeing content somewhere, it was like, oh, I saw this on this person's Blogspot account. I saw this on this person's Zanga. I saw this on this person's LiveJournal. Around that same time in grad school, I noticed that we kind of dropped describing things like that and just saying, I saw this on Tumblr. I saw this on Instagram. I saw this on Pinterest. We were completely leaving the author out. And so I think that ties back into some of the reasons why I got into NFTs. But if people have been paying attention, they also might have noticed the time like where I started becoming really loud on Twitter. I started really talking about who I was and my lived experiences, talking about race and identity. I was discovering those things in real time, but it wasn't a coincidence I decided to start using Twitter at that time, because I felt that, you know, with just a year left in school before I had to go out in the world, I had the notion that like in order to survive properly and build out a pathway for myself that wasn't dependent on other people, that this was something that I had to do. And I felt like a specific pressure. I wouldn't say it was fun, but I think in a lot of ways, I think the shape of the internet has really indirectly forced my hand throughout my career and in my life in a lot of ways.
That's a really interesting point. And I think it's probably something that we're going to come on to talk about when it comes to NFTs. But you've given us a really clear picture there, Eric, of the shape of your disillusionment at that point, you know, the whole background to it, which is obviously, you know, something you've been thinking about for a long time. I guess if we fast forward to 2021 and you make your first collection of NFTs, what was it about the NFT world, the NFT space, that gave you the sense that this was something that had huge implications for, I guess, addressing some of those concerns that you've had for a long time with the internet, as you mentioned.
I think it really was about the technology of ownership. I saw a lot of implications in being able to track, I think, the family tree and the history of an image. I think the ownership aspect was really interesting, but it wasn't until this one artist, and I can't remember her name, which is a shame, but I think she was doing something interesting with the affordances of the Ethereum network, where she normally had gallery representation. For those who might not know, it's, you know, when an artwork sells in a gallery, the artist takes 50% and then the gallery takes 50%. What she did instead was that when her NFT is sold, she would take 50%, but the rest of the 50%, rather than going to the gallery's bank account, it went to every single employee that worked at the gallery. It was programmed to just do that in perpetuity, meaning that if somebody who purchased her NFT decided to resell it, a percentage of that sale would go and be divided exactly proportionally to that person. And so to me, I think it was very clear where I was like, this was like kind of like the blueprint to a workers' co-op. And that's what really started connecting the dots. And the reason that's possible is that the reason NFTs are possible is that Ethereum allows you to create these things called smart contracts. These are contracts that automatically execute from code and don't rely on an honor system. I think for anyone that's tried to run a record label or a type foundry, a lot of it is really a handshake agreement. You know, you do have a legal contract on paper, but it's a human being at the end that's willing to obey that contract. And if you don't, like that person doesn't obey that contract, like you have to go to court, which is also determined by people. And we know that, you know, that system has its flaws. There's exploitation that goes around, there's patent trolls, there's people who don't have representation or a voice to go up against a mega corporation when their work is stolen. But this was just something that was executed by code. It was almost like a vending machine, but for like rules, basically, that you could set up. And I realized that, you know, this was something that was, to me, the way in which it did that, it was almost just like you were simply tagging somebody. And it was basically like bringing this financial layer to really familiar behavior that we had to the internet, except that it was really just exposing it to people that had been left out of that conversation, I think, historically the most. I think the shame is that there, you know, it still takes a little bit of a technical understanding of things to really understand these like deep-seated contexts. And it's really hard to just really sum up in a nice, like neatly packaged format. But basically, a lot of economic things that I was interested in, for example, I was interested in a type foundry that kind of functioned like a co-op rather than a type foundry taking 50% of a designer. A type designer is like typeface for every sale. I think even within that, like the way that money is delivered, you know, in a monthly check is also kind of flawed. This allowed me to really kind of have some like interesting thought exercises where, you know, what if instead of like as a type foundry, instead of taking 50%, I took 10% of the share, but the remaining 40% was redistributed to every single type designer in that foundry. You know, I think everybody has like different kind of seasons when it comes to like their cash flow, where I think sometimes I might be doing well and another peer might not be doing so well financially. But I think with a system like this, like there would be some kind of protection and some kind of solidarity that was built into that. I think very quickly, this myth that like cryptocurrency was this libertarian kind of utopia, I think fell apart really completely as I started to pay attention to groups like the blockchain socialists and people who are starting like these distributed kind of co-ops online. It became very clear that this was just like an amplifier, right? Like if you were an asshole and you use an amplifier, it's going to make your asshole views louder. But I think if you really thought through about ethics and equity and equality, and this was just another amplifier for you to make a lot of decisions. And these things were happening at the point of individual sales, you know, they weren't kind of collated. And so I thought that was really powerful. And to me, that was worth experimenting despite, you know, I think some of the shortcomings and imperfections of this nascent and very new technology.
It's a really clear and really interesting kind of point you make about the potential and I guess, yeah, potential on the economic systems that we have that NFTs and I guess Web3 more generally, as you call it, might have. I guess I wanted to also address the reservations that I'm sure many at the moment have when it comes to NFTs. I guess you open Twitter and you see a whole load of pictures of cartoon apes and thousands of people flogging these NFTs and trying to drum up a bit of hype around them. I know many people will see that and think the whole NFT space is ridiculous. I guess, what do you say to people like that? Do you think there's an element of truth in what they think, or is there something else, something deeper that you would say to them?
I think a lot of the art is really bad. A lot of the art is really terrible. I think a lot of the crowd that is into NFTs, I would be mortified if I had to sit down and have a cup of coffee with a lot of these folks, right? I think where me and some other peers differ is that like, to me, that's even more reason to enter this space because it needs people not like that. For me, this felt very clear that this was going to be the next logical stage of the internet, that a lot of the technologies behind NFTs were going to be, I think, really widespread and mainstream. Point blank, I was sat through and let Web2 write itself. By the time I wanted to really get involved, I think the rules were really written. It wasn't that I wasn't around. I was there. I witnessed like the rise of Web 1 and Web 2, but I just didn't really feel like engaging. I think I just kind of saw the consequences of that. Like I really didn't have a say in this, in the current landscape of the web. And so to me, it felt very clear, like rather than trying to spend all my effort to uninvent the steam engine, to try to make sure that the railroads were leading to good places, that the infrastructure being built was going to look out for other people. And also just artistically, like this was going to have wider implications on culture. And if the art was going to be bad, when it doesn't have to be bad, like, I mean, that's like the one thing like I have, I think, the most power over. And I think a lot of my peers were on the same page. I think it's easy to understand like the implications of like not participating in something, because I think that is the only power that we've been taught over the last 10 years on how to meaningfully engage in things. Like if you want to protest something, you don't give it attention or you dunk on it, you know, on social media. We've tried doing that for 10 years of things, and it really didn't really give us the outcomes that we wanted to. I don't think finger wagging was like really did anything to stop it. And so I think it required just, I think, a more kind of active participation in a space. I think the art was bad, but to me, it's like, I've always had a pretty healthy gag reflex where a lot of my peers also wasn't interested in Instagram at the same time, because I think most of the things at the time were just really badly filtered images. But I think that's sort of like if you opened up Instagram for the first time and you saw that the loading screen contained a piece of artwork that you didn't like, and you're like, well, I'm not going to learn Instagram. I would say most people would find that kind of silly. Like if you really wanted to learn how to be a music producer and you downloaded like the software and like the demo track it came with was bad, and you're like, I'm just not going to learn music, I don't think anybody would really buy that otherwise. And so I was never really deterred by the fact that it was like bad art. I'm like, yeah, I know it's bad. I know I'm not going to make bad art. I know that you could put a gun to my head, I will never make something that looks like one of those apes, you know? Like I wasn't worried for myself. I think the only other kind of misgivings I had from that is that I think what bothered me more was what I perceived to be kind of the environmental impacts of it. I was kind of really worried about it because I had seen like articles written here and there about blockchain being like really energy intensive. And so I think that was a bigger hesitation than I think any of the creative aspects of it. But I think the more I looked into it, the more I realized that like a lot of it was, I think, simply misinformation. And that I think a lot of the issues that are being talked about right now have been in the process of being addressed for like the past few years. And there's a clear roadmap for like Ethereum becoming environmentally clean. I think the more I read into it and the more I got it, I realized that I think a lot of the conversations were really shaped as a result of Web2 and its ability to really direct attention and outrage and emotions towards like very, I think, polarizing subjects. And so I think after that, I kind of just like dip my toe in. To an outside observer, it seems like this is something that I like instantly knew and understood and got into it. But it was really a slow process behind the scenes. I think the only reason that it's gotten me here to this destination maybe sooner than some other people is that I think I've been thinking about a lot of the subject matter that we've been talking about just for a long, long time. And so, you know, I think people have asked me like, you know, if you didn't have the kind of experiences you've had, would you have pursued, I think, NFTs or Web3 in the same way? Like, do you not think this is a bias? You know, I say totally, it's absolutely a bias, but I think their bias is that they haven't lived the life I've lived and they haven't seen and really studied and really predicted, I think, a lot of the things that I did too. You know, I think it's something that kind of goes both ways.
Eric, look, I think you've certainly changed my perspective on NFTs and Web3, and I hope you have for our listeners as well. I just want to say finally a massive thank you for joining us on the It's Nice That podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Eric Hu there. If you'd like to hear a longer version of that interview, well, you can by joining Extra Nice, It's Nice That's membership program. You'll get your hands on a host of benefits and goodies, including a bit more time and a few extra insights from Eric. Please do check it out. Right, that's nearly all we've got time for, but before we head off, we've got one last treat in store. Every episode of the podcast, we hear from a creative somewhere in the world as they tell us about a place in their city that keeps them inspired. For this third episode, we're heading over to Sydney to hear from the animation director and illustrator, Hane Kim, who's taking us on a tour of her local park. Let's hear from Hane.
Hey guys, this is Hane. I am an animation director and illustrator from Sydney, Australia. And today I'm coming from you from the local park from where I live. It feels pretty special being here right now. I've been in lockdown, quarantining with my partner for the past 2 weeks, and we haven't left the house, and this is the first time I'm out. And I don't know, this ordinary park that I used to go for walks around every day, it feels so magical right now. Every little thing about it, just hearing the birds or seeing people walk their dogs or people playing tennis and, you know, the old ladies at the park doing Tai Chi. It's just, I don't know, it's quite invigorating seeing life outside the realms of my apartment. That's all. Bye.
That was Hayne Kim telling us about her first trip to the park after quarantining with COVID. We're very pleased to hear that both Hayne and her partner are now on the mend. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. My thanks to Eric Hu and to my colleague Lucy Borton for joining me on this third episode. I'm sure you've all listened to podcasts before, so this won't come as a surprise. But if you enjoyed listening to this, it would make us very happy if you could write a review on your favorite podcast app. And even better, if you could also subscribe to the show. The It's Nice That podcast is produced by Palm Tree Island. Our theme music was written and performed by Sounds Like These. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next time.